The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
My name is Michael Guyon, publisher of the Lead Lag Report, is joining us here for the hour. Justin Hune, who's got a great following and is a real specialist when it comes to looking at the uranium space. Justin, for those who aren't familiar with your background, just introduce yourself to the audience as far as who you are, how'd you get involved and interested in uranium, and what are you doing now?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael. I've been involved in the markets for over a decade or so, just as a private investor, and primarily was trading momentum trading, swing trading, technical trading, up until the uranium thesis first came to me, which was 2016, which actually happened to be within a month or two of the precise bottom for the commodity. So that was interesting timing. You know, over the years, starting around that time, I just got very, very intrigued in the space. And initially, primarily that had to do with the potential for investing returns to look anything remotely like the previous bull market, which was an astonishing run from 04 to 07. You had stocks run from, pennies up to close to $10. You had stocks return thousands of times. And it was really an epic commodities run, generally speaking, but the uranium equities did profoundly well during that time. And so that got my attention as an investor. I also was just kind of intrigued with this deep contrarian type investment that I had not engaged with before that point. And the idea of something eventually working out without really having the timing, nailed down at the time. And, even now it's very difficult to time this market. But that intrigued me. And the deeper I looked into it, the more I really, recognized like how I had nuclear wrong and how how my opinions of nuclear had been formulated over the previous decade or so by all of the news around Fukushima, a lot of fear around Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, obviously in the past, and come to find out it's an unbelievable clean energy source. It's actually, in terms of lives lost per, however you want to measure it, kilowatt hour generated of energy, it's the safest form of energy that's ever been conceived. And it's far safer than anyone even recognizes. And so if you were looking for clean energy solutions, nuclear really fits the bill in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of very exciting things happening in the space, which we can talk about, during this chat. But so over the years, I was first A, intrigued by the investment potential, and then B, became a staunch advocate for nuclear energy. And it's an investment I can really feel good about. And it's an unbelievably complex world for nuclear. It's very opaque, to use a very commonly used word to describe the space, in terms of finding actual data on the nuclear fuel cycle, et cetera. So it's one of those spaces where you can really throw yourself into and educate yourself on a daily basis and continue to be humbled on a daily basis by the amount of information that can be learned in this space. You can study every day for a lifetime and not get to the bottom of things. So it keeps me on my toes. Over the last 3 years, I've built up a decent following community with the newsletter Uranium Insider Pro, which we started in August of 2019. That continues to grow and have a great community of folks there. Obviously, Twitter is a space that I enjoy very much and have a decent following there. Made a lot of good friends, a lot of good connections there. And, we find ourselves in this moment in time for uranium, for nuclear, where nuclear is really kind of catching on. We're in the early stages of what feels to be a new nuclear renaissance. and the commodity is very strong across the fuel cycle. We can talk about that more. Yet the equities have been slaughtered. I mean, we're down, 50-ish percent since the highs of last autumn. You know, it's not unique amongst commodities or amongst equities across most spaces this year to date. But we find ourselves in a very, very interesting position where it's now again a contrarian play. If you think you missed the first stage of the bull market, well, it came back to you. So super exciting space.
So I find it interesting that you were primarily a momentum and swing trader and then switch to more of a buy and hold investment thesis type of investor. I'm just curious, what made you change that approach? I mean, it's a very strong story and we'll get into it. But when you're talking about changing your own investment style to match a certain investment thesis, given the volatility in the space, that's a pretty big change in your own behavior, I would imagine.
Indeed, yes. The process was a little bit more gradual than I probably made it sound, towards, and I don't want to say the end of my momentum or swing trading time, but because I still do it to some extent, especially, I have multiple different trading accounts that I trade with different mechanisms. But, towards around the time where the nuclear thesis and the uranium thesis came to me, some of the technical trades that I had been doing, if they had been supported by something fundamental, I found it, let's say, emotionally or psychologically easier to trade that stock. And I found that it was the confidence in the trade helped me to trade it, even technically speaking. So the person who taught me a lot about technical trading, he didn't want to know a single thing about the fundamentals. He wanted to know absolutely nothing. He didn't want to touch the balance sheet. He wanted to know nothing about the sector. He wanted to look at a chart with 100% unbiased viewpoint. And I totally get that. And, he does extremely well with technical trading and he is very, very strict with his rules. If a stock breaks down below a certain level, he has closes on it. The close on the day is below that level. He's out the next morning, period, the end. And I highly respect that amount of discipline. But for myself, I found that, let's say, if a stock broke out on volume because of something extremely fundamentally strong that underpinned that move, I tended to have a better success rate with that technical trade. And that sort of just, developed into this fundamental trade for uranium. And then as I learned more about the thesis in 2016, 2017, I really was attracted to the low stress style of that type of investment that, I didn't have to think about it or look at it every single day and be married to every movement on the charts, but just say, okay, this thing, my confidence is growing that this is going to work out, let's say, in the next five-ish years or so. And the stocks have obviously been beat up. Nobody cares about this stuff right now. I can buy all that I want right now because the selling pressure is greater than the buying pressure. And so there was something about that type of investment that was very, very attractive to me and very low stress. And so the transition was relatively natural. And now most of my trading or investing, I should say, is fundamental-based.
It's so interesting to me that you characterize it as low stress because usually that which is highly volatile ends up resulting in much more stress, right? But your point about conviction is an important one, right? That if you really do believe in an investment thesis, you don't care about the short-term gyrations, right? You care that in the long run, the end point is what's reached independent of the way that it gets there.
Yeah, 100%. The conviction is absolutely necessary for the style of investing. You have to understand the companies that you're owning. You have to understand the sector. You have to feel confident in the eventual outcome of it. Otherwise, the volatility will absolutely shake you out. And, I should also say that, everybody has their own unique style of investing or trading. And what works for me doesn't necessarily work for other people. And clearly, judging by the number of people that have thrown in the towel over the past couple of months, that's probably pretty obvious. But there's a lot of arguments we'll see on Twitter back and forth between people with different viewpoints. And most of the time that's completely useless because people have different objectives, different amounts of money, they're at a different stage in their life. Some people right now are doing a pretty good job of ticking the tops and bottoms on these intra-cycle moves. And other people are willing to perfectly, hold through a 40, 50, 60% drawdown because they don't want to create a tax event and they bought in much lower. They just want to hang on for the next few years. Both people can be right. So yeah, but that's just my style as of now, especially with this particular investment.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live.
Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
All right. Now, you had mentioned Fukushima, Three Mile Island. I actually just not too long ago watched the Netflix documentary on Three Mile Island. And it seems to me that the real problem that the industry faces is a behavioral one, right? That it's really all about the availability heuristic, right? People assigning the probabilities of mass casualties being higher with nuclear than not because of these big events in history, right? It's no different than why people think that flying is more dangerous than driving, right? In terms of probabilities, because you can imagine the plane crashing, but not necessarily the same.
100%. Yeah. The problem with nuclear over the past few decades really has been a messaging problem.
Sorry, real quick, because I don't know how much it's ended. Unfortunately, I had a call just come in and it cut me off. But that point about the availability heuristic, I think, is an important one because that's very hard to break because that's kind of just us being humans. We automatically go to the extreme event in history and assume that that's a tell on future probabilities when in reality it's actually not.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, there's been a major messaging problem with nuclear, especially over the past couple of decades with the all-out push by governments towards clean energy, primarily with renewables. While up until recently, not really including nuclear in that mix. If you go back a couple of years and look at, for example, the Green New Deal that was promoted by, let's say, the environmental left amongst the federal government in the United States, this had extremely alarmist language in terms of, you know, the world is going to end in 10 years if we don't reduce our carbon, you know, our carbon emissions. Also, we're phasing out nuclear. And it's like, yeah, you just can't have both of those things. Like it's one or it's the other. And they really got called out on that to the point where they actually ended up changing the language in that proposal. I see that Mark Nelson is listening here and he's done an incredible job of messaging facts about the nuclear industry, calling out the misinformation, et cetera. And there's a number of people, himself, Michael Schellenberger, Isabel, I'm forgetting her last name at this moment, Isodope. They're all doing unbelievable job of speaking the truth about nuclear. And finally, it seems like the worm is turning and we're seeing more support even from the environmental left, not only in the States and Europe. You know, nuclear was just included in the green taxonomy. So a lot of positive moves in terms of actually recognizing that, oh, nuclear is clean, oh, it actually is safe, et cetera. That, and it's taking a long time. Whereas to now you have, you know, the majority of the population in Japan, for example, in support of restarting nuclear plants. And that's, you know, that shift just shifted to the majority within the last 12 months. So this is, it's a big movement. And, you know, it's now is the time. We're seeing massive energy crises across the globe. And now the world is watching Germany, for example, that's seeing a major crunch that, you know, they don't even know if they're going to have those gas deliveries from Russia in a few months going into winter, yet they're sticking to their guns in terms of shutting down their nukes. Their remaining three plants that are set to close in December, my understanding, the three they closed last December, two of those are still technically able to be restarted if they were to do so. So yeah, the narrative is shifting and it's taken a very long time, but public opinion finally is on our side, generally speaking. It's hard to say how much, you know, the saving of these last three plants in Germany will actually move the needle in terms of how it affects, you know, the finance in the country. But it's clear that it would help their energy situation. I think that's unbelievably obvious. You know, for us, it's been, we're not holding our breath because of how corrupt politics can be, especially with the Greens in Germany. So, but it's obvious now to us and to anybody who's paying attention that they absolutely should keep these last three plants online. They should restart the couple of nukes that they shut down that can be restarted. That would be good for the country. That would be good for the populace. That would be good for them buffering any gas deliveries that might not come through. It's just so obvious, but you know, we don't hold our breath with matters of politics like this. We did see Belgium recently shift. So, you know, and we obviously see France, they've haven't done the greatest job in maintaining their existing fleet, at least EDF over the past decade, which is we're seeing some maintenance outages that are affecting about half of the nuclear reactors in France, which is creating a bit of a situation there because they're the biggest exporter of energy on the planet. And a lot of the surrounding countries are going to be really needing those electricity exports going into the winter. So it's a mess right now. It really is a mess right now.
You mentioned that there's this huge performance disconnect between the commodity side and the equity side. And that's not uncommon when you look at stocks that are supposed to track or play off of a commodity thesis, right? Gold and gold miners is kind of a classic example. I've actually done a lot of back tests trying to see if the price of gold tells you anything about miners' future performance. And believe it or not, there's actually not very much of a correlation because oil ends up being a bigger driver of earnings variability for gold mining stocks. Talk about how you think about the equity side versus the commodity side, those disconnects, and how strong of a relationship do the uranium equity plays have to uranium itself historically?
Historically, the uranium equities are pretty highly correlated to the commodity itself. You know, it really was a bull market for the commodity during the last bull market, and the equities followed suit in a major, major way. This is a really interesting situation here because we have every element of the fuel cycle in a very strong uptrend, especially conversion, enrichment, UF6 and EUP over the past 3 to 4 months with the advent of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That's completely upended especially the enrichment and conversion markets in the West for the Western utilities. And that's an inflection that's happening literally right now, literally under our feet. And I can get a little bit more deeply into that, but just to give a reference point in terms of the equities performance relative to the commodity, if you actually chart, for example, URA relative to the spot price of uranium, we are literally back at valuation levels prior to what I believe and what I call the beginning of the bull market, which is December 2020. That's when equities really started to take off. Equities started to move before the commodity did itself, but that's when things really started to take off. Obviously, March 2020 was the lows for most of the stocks in the space, but the bull market really, really started, in my opinion, December 2020. That's when we saw real volume come in, and that's kind of the trigger, in my opinion. We're back at those levels, literally, relative to the commodity. So now that we have the commodity, has moved up 50% since December 2020. And the equities, many of them have done far greater than that over that period of time, despite this large pullback. The fundamental change in, let me put that differently. The developments, fundamentally speaking, since the bull market started are profound. We have not only the existence of the SPUT vehicle, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, which is a highly liquid, majority institutional investor-owned vehicle that purchases physical uranium when they're at a premium to their net asset value. They've soaked up 38 million pounds of U308 in less than a year. That vehicle has profoundly changed at least the spot market. And it's added a lot of transparency to the spot market as well. So it's really made clear that the U308 market in terms of above ground mobile inventory is relatively thin in terms of what's available for sale. They actually cleared out a lot of carried pounds over that time period as well. So these are pounds that carry traders had purchased from offtakes or off the spot market when they signed, let's say, mid to long-term contracts with utilities. And when the market got severely backwardated because of SPUT back in August, September, October, November, these carry traders were selling those carried pounds to SPUT and then covering their contractual obligations by assigning midterm contracts with other entities at a lower price. So that cleared out a lot of these carried pounds, and it just really thinned out the market. And now the same thing has happened in UF6. Although it's not because of SPUT, they only buy U308. Now we have the situation where there's somewhat of a scramble by Western utilities to buy up what they can of UF6, EUP. They're seeking out spot conversions, spot enrichment, and increasingly so, we're looking at more volume coming into term contracts for enrichment conversion. And that's about to trickle down to U308. So it's kind of a complex situation with the fuel cycle back end. But in terms of the equities, they've just been thrown out as the baby with the bathwater with a risk-off situation across all markets. I mean, there's no other way really to explain it. Fundamentally speaking, things have only gotten, I hate to say better because of a lot of the reasoning for that has to do with war and a bifurcated market that we're looking at here now. But the truth be told, the equities are as cheap as they've ever been in terms of relative pricing to the commodity itself. Thank you, Ben. I appreciate that. Honestly, this is probably a better question for Mark, but just briefly, the nuclear waste is in far lower volume than most people understand. The example I always like to give, which I heard a number of years ago, which was shocking to me at the time, is that all of the nuclear energy that's been produced in the United States throughout its history has produced enough waste to fill a football field about 30 feet high. And the U.S. is the largest nuclear energy producer in the world. So it's the waste is really essentially a non-issue. In the United States currently, we don't have a central repository. So the waste is stored on site at the facility where the energy is produced and the waste is produced. It's stored in heavy-duty casks that are sealed in concrete and steel. We've never had an accident with the waste. And increasingly, there's definitely technologies that are out there that in the future of advanced nuclear could potentially utilize this waste as future fuel. So it's really, the waste is a non-issue, in my opinion, and it's really a minimal amount of waste relative to the energy that's produced by nuclear. But I'm absolutely willing to allow Mark to jump in here if he wants. I don't know that. I don't know the answer to that question in terms of storage prior to reprocessing into fuel in the future. I mean, some waste is already being reprocessed currently by the French. They have something called MOX fuel, mixed oxide fuel, that does fuel a percentage of their reactors. And so waste currently is being recycled in some scenarios. So it is possible. And my understanding is there's, you know, future technologies that will be able to utilize this waste for advanced nuclear.
Go ahead, Mark, if you want to add some thoughts to that.
Sure. Yeah. So when fuel goes into a reactor, it typically is in there for about 5 years. Reactors are refueled 2 times while a fuel rod is sitting there being used. And on the third time, typically after 5 or 5.5 years, that fuel rod will be taken out. It will be very radioactive. The radioactivity is mostly, primarily coming from the fission products. That means when you break apart a big chubby uranium atom, you get some combination of 2 smaller particles, usually. And those smaller particles can either be 1 tiny particle and 1 much larger one, or they can be 2 evenly sized particles. When it's 2 evenly sized particles, those fission products are themselves radioactive because they have too many neutrons. They are unstable. They are too chubby. And they're going to keep breaking down for some period of time, but they are also too small to make more energy in a nuclear reaction later. So you can't keep splitting them and still make energy out of them. So they're pretty much complete waste products. Now, those fission products, they're going to be radioactive in a way that matters to health in the concentration that you find them in fuel rods for a number of years. The rule of thumb for the amount of time you have to wait until the fission products are cooled off all the way down to where you could just have them nearby humans and not have an issue is about 500 years. Don't let that scare you. That's a very conservative standard being used. Now, the other thing that can happen in a nuclear reactor is that uranium gets an extra neutron and gets larger, gets even chubbier. Those are transuranics, meaning the elements, the heavy elements that are nearby uranium on the periodic table. That's where you get your plutonium. Much of the plutonium that you produce in that fuel is going to be broken down as the fuel stays in the reactor if you had it there long enough. There's going to be some plutonium left after you take the fuel rod out of the reactor. What the French do is they let the fuel rods cool off for a few years, and then they chop up the fuel rods, dissolve the uranium and plutonium and all the fission products. They just dissolve it all into a liquid. They separate out those little fission products, the annoying things that don't give you much useful energy. And then they put the uranium and the plutonium, which are technically radioactive, but not particularly. They don't really require much shielding. They're not particularly dangerous to handle in terms of fission coming or spontaneous fission or breakdowns. I mean, they would definitely set off all sorts of alarms, but you wouldn't find it to be violently dangerous to human health, right? Those uranium and plutonium isotopes will then go back into the mixed oxide fuel and back into French reactors. So that reduces the uranium mined by approximately 50%. That is, you get about 50% more energy per mined uranium atom than you would if you didn't do that fuel cycle. Not that many countries do it because it's a lot of hassle for not a huge amount of real benefit, but the French do it. So there you go. In terms of reusing even more than just 50% more energy, about 50% less mining. So it's about 100% more energy through this so-called twice through fuel cycle, the mixed oxide cycle that the French use. The alternative is fast reactors. These are reactors designed to have a ton of high energy neutrons flying all around in the core. Then you can actually break down a bigger variety of isotopes and get more energy from a bigger variety of substances in the fuel. And you can transform more isotopes into usable fuel in the fuel as the reactor operates. There are already fast reactors in operation. The Russians have a successful program where for 20 or 30 years, they've been running one or more so-called fast reactors out at Belayarsk in northern Russia. But although it does work, the whole point of nuclear is that you need almost no fuel for nuclear. So although it's a very cool story and I love the technology, and you know, Bill Gates is working on his fast reactor for deployment in Wyoming here in 10 or 12 years, it's not required to solve the nuclear waste issue. To solve the nuclear waste issue, you need visitor centers, you need museum exhibits, you need really good public access, you need clever decoration, you need art, and that way people can see and interact safely with nuclear waste canisters. There's no risk of it being taken. You just make it extremely heavy and you can't really move it. So what that means is solving nuclear waste is immediate and in our hands, and it's about the public trusting us to manage the waste. And that is about public access, bright colors, school groups going in, and things like that. I'll send a tweet to Michael for him to put in the nest if he's interested, that shows how the Dutch have already managed to do this.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do that. But everybody that's here, just to reset real quick, please make sure you follow Justin Hewn, Uranium Insider, here on Twitter, as well as Mark Nelson, who I had on a space, and his video is up on my YouTube channel at the Lead Lag Report. Let's get Justin, if you want to add some other thoughts, and I'll get some of the audience here.
Sure. No, thank you so much, Mark. I completely agree with you that it, you know, your closing statement on what you just shared is as far as a totally different way of interacting with the public in terms of nuclear waste and nuclear energy in general. I think Isabel is doing a phenomenal job with exactly that. So I'm 100% behind you on that one.
But let's also, just for the audience, just for those that are not as familiar with these terms like SMR, maybe Justin kind of go through a little bit of that and to get to the answer there.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, SMR stands for small modular reactor, and it's kind of a technology that's a category, let's say, of nuclear that's been being developed over quite some time now, but it's really gaining steam right now. There's a lot of new companies, private and a couple public, that are working on these things, and it's very, very exciting. Generally speaking, they're much smaller than the average reactor that's currently operating. They're modular, hence the name. And oftentimes they can be sort of daisy chained, connected to each other. They can be implemented into much smaller grids. A lot of the technologies that are being worked on right now for SMRs are much safer. Some of them, quote unquote, meltdown proof. But as far as this gentleman's specific question about the waste issue being addressed by SMRs, I'll leave that to Mark, if that's okay.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Yes, and I love the question, love the insight, and half-lives are really important. The shorter the half-life, the more radioactive, but the faster it's gone. The longer the half-life, the less radioactive, but the longer it lasts. That is a key insight that almost nobody in the world that I've ever talked to that is worried about nuclear waste has understood. So that leads me to say the following.
You're saying if you understand this, to be clear. Okay.
Correct. People say it's super radioactive and will be for millions of years. Well, okay. So if it's radioactive for millions of years, then it's not radioactive. It's not particularly, it's very weakly or almost irrelevantly radioactive. If it's extremely radioactive, then it's something that goes away very rapidly. The trouble comes when you have things that are medium half-lives. So this is, depending on what we're talking about, that can be the things with half-lives of several days to several decades. That's the trouble period. And then the second layer of trouble comes when you have elements that, because of their chemical, not their radioactive properties, but their chemical properties, bind to other atoms in ways that can either accumulate in the body or get taken up as tissue. So, for example, in the last 24 hours, I've been dealing with somebody in the finance space who jumped in to complain about Japan allowing water with a very tiny amount of tritium, an extremely weakly radioactive, at the concentrations we're talking about, a weakly radioactive isotope of hydrogen that it can be bound to oxygen to make slightly radioactive water. He was complaining about that being released into the ocean, an ocean that, of course, has weak radioactivity all over it. Yeah. And what I was trying to explain to him was the tritium, you can't bioaccumulate it. You pee it out. You go do a workout and you sweat it out. There's no way to store this tritium in higher concentrations over time in your body, meaning you would have to keep consuming tons of tritium water at concentrations vastly beyond that in these storage tanks at the Fukushima Daiichi site. And then I realized, does he really care about tritium? Is this guy really worried about the science? No. He gets bad vibes and he went to search for a news article with scary words to share it to show his bad vibes. So let's be frank here, guys. This is a bad vibes issue and we can cure it with better vibes. Michael, I sent you on your DM's post essentially making this point where the Dutch built a facility with extremely good vibes. It's got a great visitor center. It's got a cafe. It's not open yet, but I'm urging them to open as soon as possible. It's got an excellent guided tour from the guy who came up with the facility. They used great architects, really beautiful and fascinating paint colors. And you don't have to wear a special mask. You don't have to wear a hard hat. You just go visit. And they say things like, hey, you can wear one of these radiation badges if you want, but you don't have to. It's up to you. Some people like to, some people don't. That is the sort of thing that just screams confidence in your engineering and confidence in the public to be able to tell the difference between people you can trust and people you can't trust. So although we could ask which SMRs have different isotopes that come out, nobody actually cares about isotopes until they've already decided to either love or hate nuclear. What we want to intervene in is that decision point on whether to love or hate nuclear. And we can do that by rejecting the framework that nuclear waste, the end of the nuclear mining cycle, is some special hideous thing that has to be kept far away from human life. No. You can walk around nuclear waste and it's totally fine. You would need a reason to do that. That's the museum. And then once people see that you can trust the nuclear waste, that you can go and see it and you can be around it and it's not scary, the fact that there's almost none of it will become the next thing that matters. And that you'll have to, because there's so little nuclear waste, you'll have to wait in line at the ticket booking office to go see it because there's almost none of it. A whole country can run their entire society off of nuclear waste and there can be a need for no more than one or two small waste facilities. That's the magic of nuclear.
Yeah, thank you for that. So you're correct. The Cameco, they announced in February that they had signed 40 million pounds in U308 contracts year to date, which was about 5 weeks. That was more than they had signed the entire previous year. Year to date, there's been a total of 70 million pounds of U308 contracted in long-term contracts. And I'm confident that'll break the 100 million pound mark for the year. That'll be the first year since 2012 that we've seen more than 100 million pounds of U308 contracted. So the long-term contracting cycle is picking up right now. This really is kind of the early stages of a contracting cycle for U308. Now, utilities, generally speaking, have undergone the process of contracting and do all the time. And that can look like a lot of different things. And you are correct that right now, the biggest concern, at least in the West, is a conversion enrichment. So just to kind of try and paint a picture. So Russia currently has over 40% of the global enrichment capacity. On top of that, Russian SWU, typically they can spin their centrifuges down all the way down as low as 0.1, which is very, very low in terms of tails assays. Now, typically they will run it a little bit higher than that. And let's say on average of the past number of years, tails assays in the West have been somewhere between, let's say, 0.18 to 0.2. And what that is that's the U235 percentage that remains in the tails material after the enrichment process. So the enrichers will contract with utilities for EUP, for enriched uranium product, and they will do so at a certain tails assay. And that will actually dictate two things. That'll dictate pricing and the amount of energy needed to spin the feed material, the UF6, into the enriched uranium product, which is what the utility is contracting for. And two, it'll dictate how much feed will be going into the centrifuge to produce that EUP. So the OECD, let's say, has somewhere in the 70th percentile of global nuclear utilities in terms of energy production. They have a minority of the enrichment. So the Russians have over 40%, the Chinese have some, and the rest that's in the West, most of that's in Europe. So there's, what, 27 million SWU in the OECD, and there's less than 5 million SWU in the US, for example. And so what we're facing right now is a market where the Western utilities are already, even though Russian enrichment hasn't officially been, let's say, cut off or sanctioned by either the EU or the US, we're seeing a situation right now where the primary shipper of Russian uranium products is a Canadian shipper. And just a few weeks ago, they were actually not allowed to load the Russian material to ship it to, I think it was three separate entities in the United States. They were given an exemption. And what we're hearing so far is that's an exemption through 2023 to allow this Canadian shipper to go around the sanctions that have been applied in Canada for them to ship Russian material to the States or in general. So we have the bulk of the nuclear energy production globally in the quote unquote West trying to figure out how the heck they're going to get the enrichment that they need from Western sources. That has obviously been a major influence on the pricing of enrichment and of SWU, and of EUP over the past few months. We've seen them big price spikes and also conversion. The Russians control 30 something percent of conversion. And so what's happening right now is not only are utilities buying what they can on the spot market in terms of UF6 and EUP, which from what I hear, there's basically very, very little, if any, UF6 just kind of above ground available on the spot market. So conversion is being sought out as well. And what not only are a number of utilities doing what they can to contract for that enrichment, but they're also just trying to wrap their heads around what will be available in terms of enrichment going forward. So they have to understand the availability of SWU in the West out when that particular utility happens to be uncovered for their nuclear fuel requirements. Now, on average, in the United States, utilities have about 2 years of inventory. That's all elements throughout the fuel cycle. Inventory includes what's literally sitting at their facility. It includes U3O8 or UF6 held at any of the conversion facilities, et cetera. So 2 years on average. The EU has on average about 3 years. So the utilities have to figure out, okay, what sort of SWU is going to be available in the West in 2024, 2025, 2026. And at that point, they can understand, and not only with the SWU availability, but what are the tails assays that are part of that equation. We're already hearing that the tails assays at some of the Western enrichers are rising into the mid-20s, like 0.24, 0.25. It's unlikely we're going to see that stop. It's likely we're going to see the tails assays rise and rise for the enrichers in the West. Because if we are cutting off Russia for enrichment services to the Western utilities, that is the only way for us to get the needed enrichment for the utilities in the West. That's kind of a long-winded way to say this literally is an inflection point right now. There's a relatively important meeting happening, an NEI meeting happening next week in DC. All of the players from the utilities, from the enrichers, are going to be at this meeting. It's likely the DOE is going to do something in the next number of weeks to months in terms of possibly downblending to add to the enrichment supply, because the US is in the trickiest position with less than 5 million SWU and 90 reactors operating. So all of that is to say, these rising tails assays for the enrichers is going to have vastly, vastly increased demand on uranium, to the point I don't even want to put a number on it yet, but we could be looking at a hugely increased demand for U308 and UF6 going forward in the next coming years due to the rising tails assays for the enrichers. And so the entire market is inflecting literally right now, literally under our feet. The market is effectively now bifurcated. As far as the Chinese and the Indians doing business with the Russians and in the BRICS countries, et cetera, we're going to have to see how that plays out. It's likely that a lot of the Russian material... Now, the Russians don't have a ton of U308. Most of the U308 production they have is joint ventures with Kazatomprom, but they do obviously have a lot of conversion and enrichment. And if the demand is lowered on Russian enrichment, then they're going to be able to run much lower tails assays, possibly re-enrich tails material, underfeed, et cetera. So that could go a long way to supplying China with that material. Does that have me concerned? Not really. The market in terms of investing is likely going to be paying attention to the Western side of that bifurcation. Also, China is going absolutely gangbusters on building nuclear reactors. They have 19 reactors under construction right now. So even if they're sitting on 300-400 million pounds of U3O8 equivalent inventory, building out their own conversion and enrichment fuel fab, they're an absolute behemoth and they're going to need more uranium going forward. So that's really just kind of a long-winded way to say that demand for U3O8 is coming. We can measure the timeline for that demand in weeks or months, not years. And it's just a matter of figuring out how much SWU is going to be available and conversion is going to be available to the West. And then the utilities, in my opinion, are going to start acquiring the needed U308 because it's going to go through the roof based on these rising tails assays.
Let's get a little bit into the investment universe for a moment here, because, and I don't know the answer to this, but I'm going to assume there are not that many stocks that one can necessarily find and invest in. And probably most people would simply access an ETF to track the space. But obviously you've got premium research out there, you're doing deep dive analysis. How large is the universe of investments, and is it a space where there is kind of a winner take all momentum effect in some big players, or is there sort of a differentiation that's large enough that allows for those to want to find something really undervalued to invest in?
Well, you know, generally speaking, the rising tide does lift all boats. But if you look at charts historically over the past, let's say, 3 years, you've seen massive, massive differences in performance. You've seen some stocks up maybe 100% over the last 3 years. You've seen some stocks still at, you know, 8 to 10x, even though they've pulled back 40, 50% in the past 6 to 8 months. So there definitely is differences in terms of performance. And of course, really, you know, it's difficult to give, I don't want to give investing advice, and I don't want to give away individual names because of our paying subscribers. But, you know, the universe is very small. There's what, about 70 companies in the uranium space. The entire publicly traded space is sitting, what, less than $35 billion here. It's a tiny, tiny space. And when institutional money comes in, they've got, you can count on one hand their options, right? They can go for the ETFs, they can go for SPUT, they can go for NextGen, Cameco, maybe Denison, and that's pretty much it. Maybe because Kazatomprom as well. So the space is very, very small in terms of institutional money. Obviously, when institutional money flows into SPUT and into the ETFs, it has kind of a flywheel effect that we call it, which, you know, those ETFs buy their underlying holdings, and SPUT buys physical uranium, and it moves kind of the whole market. As far as, you know, what we like to look for in terms of investments, we like to look for companies that have individual company catalysts, where even if the market doesn't go the way that we believe it will, these catalysts can still move the company forthrightly. And those have been the biggest winners for us in the past and where we're currently positioned now. You know, the explorers are more of a gamble. If you bet big on an explorer and they hit pay dirt during a bull market, you could see astronomical returns. But it's obviously, it's more of a gamble. These smaller market cap companies have to dilute pretty heavily in order to get drills turning. Yeah, so it's tricky. I think the best thing I can say is look for companies that have an expected catalyst in the next, let's say, 12, 24, 36 months and beyond that will enable the company to propel itself forward despite market conditions, though we expect those market conditions to turn relatively soon. I mean, we're pretty beholden to the broad markets here, but like I mentioned recently, you know, just a few minutes ago, in terms of the fundamentals for the market and where we see U308 going, we could have a very, very strong move towards the end of this year, into next year and beyond.
And presumably, and maybe this is just my own naivete, presumably those catalysts tend to be driven by, you know, government actions, right, in terms of supporting the space. But what are the kinds of catalysts that you've seen in your research that are important to be on the lookout for?
Well, you know, it's I hate to say it, but the movement of the spot price really is something that's going to grab investors' attention. And that's unfortunately what most investors watch, because it's probably the least relevant element of the entire fuel cycle, but it is the most visible. It does still affect contracts. Long-term contracts still oftentimes will have a significant portion of the contract reference to the market. So even going out 3, 4, 5 years, oftentimes we'll see contracts that are fixed at a certain price, and then they'll have a certain portion of the contract that's a market reference at the time of delivery, with usually floor and ceiling pricing worked into that contract. So the spot price matters and it doesn't matter. In terms of volume, it really doesn't matter. We've got a couple million pounds a month on average coming into the spot market from primary production. It's where utilities don't really play in the spot market very much at all. It's primarily traders, and, you know, more than half of the volume in the spot market over the past year has been SPUT. So it's, but it is the most visible element amongst the fuel cycle, and it's what investors tend to watch. So as far as catalysts go, you know, honestly, I don't really expect any huge major individual catalysts coming from governments or otherwise. It's really just going to be the fuel cycle fundamentals playing out, and we're going to be able to bear witness to that. And it's happening right now in the back end. It's just nobody sees it unless you subscribe to, you know, an expensive nuclear fuel consultancy, and those numbers come out once a month to the public. So without really being steeped in the back end of the fuel cycle, it's difficult to really understand what's going on in the fuel cycle, in the market for utilities and for the various elements of the fuel cycle, and to understand what's coming. And that's what we try to distill down to investors by grasping what we're seeing in the back end and estimating when that's going to hit the front end, which is to say the U308 market. And we believe that's coming and probably soon. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, generally speaking, the spot price and the long-term price move together. The spot price moves with more volatility, but typically they will move up and down together. The term price is much more stable, but it also is in an uptrend. So that is moving along with the spot price. And the spot price is going to have intraday, intraweek, intramonth gyrations that really have absolutely nothing to do with the contracting cycle or the contracts that are being signed. So while a lot of the contracting activity, let's say, is behind NDAs and not made public, you know, most of the market really finds out about the contracting activity from the quarterly CAMCO conference calls. But the spot price will move along with the rest of the market. So really, the spot price moves a lot with SPUTS activity, which has to do with financial risk coming back into the markets. But these contracts that I mentioned do have reference to the spot price. And so the contracting cycle will affect the spot market and does affect the spot market. It just moves. I mean, right now we're just seeing UG sell pounds from Niger into the spot market right now. That's literally, you know, trickling small volumes into the spot market. It's moving the price down, moving the price up on a daily basis. It's literally noise. So until you actually see volume come into the spot market, whether that's from SPUT, whether that's from traders, whether that's from utilities, you know, these intraday moves in the spot price really honestly should be ignored. And over time, the fundamentals in the fuel cycle and the fundamentals for the investment will play out. That's why it's just so important to keep your eye on the long-term price, to zoom out. You know, weekly charts are good, that sort of thing. They are correlated, but if you look at it on a daily basis, you're not going to see that correlation. But if you zoom out, the correlation is absolutely there.
I think that's a good way to end the space. Everybody here, please make sure you follow Justin Huhn. You can check out his research. I believe you have the link on your profile, right, Justin?
I do. Yes, sir.
Yeah, readinginsider.com. And special thanks to Mark Nelson for helping, as well as all the other people that ask questions. I mentioned I'm definitely under the weather today, so to have others carry the heavy load with questions is always appreciated. Follow Justin, follow Mark Nelson. I'll do another space tomorrow, and everybody enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you, guys.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.